the way it goes. All right. Good morning to all you who are here. Let me give you some handouts here. Pass it out, and I will pray. Father, we thank you for this opportunity to get together again, finally, after so long, and be able to dive back into church history and pray you make our minds fresh and sharp and alert, and help us to profit from the materials that we look at this morning. Pray in Christ's name. Amen. So are y'all ready for the review of last time? I didn't think so. I wasn't even ready. I looked up my review quest. I thought, huh? What was that? I don't remember covering that. But I did. We covered the mystics and we covered Dante's comedy and all that, you know. But it was a comedy when you saw me looking at it. But anyhow, now we're going to look at the next topic, which is the Hundred Years' War. So you thought we were in the Middle East for a long time? No. This is back when men were men and they fought long wars and whatever it's worth. So yeah, there's a Hundred Years' War. And the Hundred Years' War is the dominant political and military event of the 14th and 15th centuries. As you might imagine, I mean, a war that transverses much of Europe. It's actually mostly between England and France, but there were a lot of other countries got dragged into it. It was a series of conflicts in which five generations of kings, think about that, five generations of kings from two rival dynasties, or as D.A. Carson would say, dynasties, fought for the throne of the largest kingdom in Western Europe. Although basically a conflict between France and England, this war so involved the rest of Europe that some historians have suggested that it be called the First European War. And you see throughout history, starting in this time period, that there's a continual battle between France and England. They are foes for centuries, literally centuries. But think about that, 100 years war. There's nobody who was there in the beginning who could have been of adult age and lived to the end. I mean, it's just this war that they've been fighting for generations, and we kind of inherited the thing. And, you know, it's just, that's amazing. I'm blown away by the idea of 100 years war. So, kind of the way this worked is that repeatedly the English invaded France. They won impressive victories on the battlefield, but then were forced to withdraw due to lack of funds. So it's kind of a frustrating cycle of events here. And of course, you remember several centuries earlier, it was France in the Norman invasion that invaded Great Britain. And so now the British are returning the favor. By 1378, the French, under King Charles the Wise, also known as Charles V, had recovered most of the lands they lost, leaving the English with only a few cities on the continent. So it's one of those deals where the English came in, they took over a bunch of stuff, ran out of funds. The French gathered up forces, drove them back out again. And I think this went on cyclically for much of this 100-year period. In the following decades, however, the newly crowned Henry V of England seized the opportunity presented by, number one, the mental illness of Charles VI, who was the next French king, and the fact that the French were involved in a civil war. So it's kind of like, you know, when you fight the Arabs, you know, they're often so busy fighting each other that it kind of helps you out because they keep each other occupied. It's kind of the way it was with the French. They had this civil war going on, and the English thought, you know, we got a king down there who's got some mental health problems, and they got a big civil war going on. This might be a good time to make a move. Maybe we can go down there. Maybe we can actually hold some territory for a change. So they made the move. English and their allies were winning when Charles VI, the guy with the mental problems, died. So Charles VI's son, Dauphin, whose party had been losing in the French Civil War, so while the Civil War was going on, his party wasn't doing so well, but his dad was the emperor, and he's with the mental problem, his dad dies, And so he declares that he's now the king, and he calls himself Charles the Seventh. Hey, that was my dad, and he was king, and so he was Charles the Sixth, and he's died, and so, hey, I'm king now, Charles the Seventh. And, well, he was besieged in a town called Orleans, not New Orleans. New Orleans was probably named after Orleans, like it was. He was besieged there, and he got holed up, basically, surrounded by the British troops in 1429. And he had little hope of truly becoming the ruler of France. Now, he could declare yourself the ruler of France all you want. That doesn't make you the ruler of France, right? People have to buy into that, and that didn't seem very likely at this point. And then here he was, besieged by the British. He's in trouble. And then all of a sudden, though, many of his former enemies decided that now that his father was dead, maybe they should support him, you know? I mean, his dad was king, after all. Maybe he should be the king. So they kind of rallied behind the guy, but he's still being besieged. He's got a problem. And it was also at this time that Dauphin first heard of a young woman who we're going to take a look at named Joan of Arc. How many of you have heard of Joan of Arc? I think everybody's heard of Joan of Arc. Very well-known name in history. Very well-known to Catholics. She, as we're going to see, became a figure that they have revered for centuries now. And he heard of this lady, Joan of Arc. She's from a little village up in northwestern France. And so here's a little bit of a map I got going for you here. So the siege of Orleans, here's Orleans here. It's on the river right here in the middle. You can see here's Great Britain. Here's the English Channel. Here's Normandy. You know, a lot of significance historically of Normandy. And you can see from the coloring here that the British have kind of they've occupied and taken over a lot of the French northern territory here. And here you got this guy holed up in Orleans, kind of almost surrounded by the British troops. And he's in a bad way. He's in a very bad way. Well, Joan of Arc claimed that she had visions of Saints Catherine and Margaret and of the Archangel Michael. So that's a triple whammy. You may remember the name Catherine. She is one of the mystics that we looked at last time, and she's the one that talked the Pope into moving back to Rome and all that kind of stuff. We looked at her a little bit. I don't think we looked at Margaret. Of course, Archangel Michael, the Jehovah Witnesses, will talk your ear off endlessly about that one, as will other groups. But it's a biblical character. You know. Anyway, she claims to have had a vision from this angel and from these two people, saints who have passed on, women who were revered women within the Catholic faith. And in the vision, she claimed they ordered her to lead Dauphin's troops to break the siege of Orleans and then have him crowned at Reims, the place where kings of France were traditionally crowned. Now, that's a pretty tall order, right? I mean, this lady, first of all, ladies didn't normally fight in war. I mean, they don't today, they didn't then. So for a lady to even fight as a soldier, much less lead the troops, was a kind of a big thing. And then here you got a guy who's losing, and he's in big trouble, but she's going to lead his troops and win. And then she's going to take this guy to the place where they crown kings in France and get him crowned as king. Now, that's a pretty tall claim. You know, I had this vision, and this is what's supposed to happen. Okay. So on hearing this, Dauphin, who was somewhat skeptical, as you might imagine, of her claims, went ahead and sent for her, because she was claiming this, and maybe he did it to amuse himself. I don't know why he sent for her, but he sent for her. But the thing is, Joan convinced him to trust her. How? I don't know. she just said, what do you got to lose? Right? I mean, give it a shot. Or maybe she, I don't know. Somehow she convinced him that he should go ahead and trust her in this role. And so she was sent across enemy lines to bring back to the city supplies that were sorely needed. I think it was like toilet paper, hand sanitizer, stuff like that. I don't know. No, wait a minute, I got in the wrong thing. Chronological error there. as you know, a city that's besieged, I mean, that's one of the things that happens. You run out of food, you run out of supplies because you can't get out to get the stuff you need because there's an army out there and they'll kill you if you go get it. So they say, hey, do us a favor, go get us some supply, go get us some weapons, go get us some food. So she was, he said, okay, you're going to lead the army, let's see you do this. So she was allowed to lead an attack against the besiegers, the British who were surrounding, and she had tremendous success. I mean, she pulled it off. What? And then, as you might imagine, rumors circulated in the enemy camp of this young maiden clad in armor who every day came out of the city and every day took one of their bastions. She kept going out repeatedly on various runs and was successful every time. And they're like, it's led by a woman, and she's wearing armor, and she's whipping our behinds out here. This is amazing. What is going on? It's got to scare them a little bit. So finally, the siege was broken. They said, why not? You know, they gave up. The enemy withdrew. The Maid of Orleans, as she was called at the time, did not allow Dauphin's troops to follow the retreating armies. So you would think, I mean, at a time when you've got the other armies on the run, the natural thing to do is send your armies after them and just wipe them out while they're running away from you and be done with them. And she goes, no, you guys can't do that. She said, it's Sunday, and Sunday's the day for prayer, not battle, so we're not going to go chase after them. I'm like, okay. Well, from that point on, the course of the war changed. The French, tired of civil war, flocked to Dauphin's standards. So they were tired of fighting with each other. They said, you know what, we're going to rally around the Dauphin guy. And Joan was able to accompany him in triumphant march to Reims. That's where they crowned kings, as we pointed out earlier. This and other cities that had held out against him opened their gates. He was finally crowned in the Cathedral of Reims while the Maid of Orleans stood by the altar. What a grand picture, okay? Got this lady who had this vision, and she was successful. And here you got this guy who's a descendant of a line of kings, and everybody's giving up their arms against each other. They're all gathering under his banner. Things are looking good. So at this point, Joan of Arc wanted to go back to the village where she came from. She was done. She wasn't in it for just continuing fame and continuing fortune. She wanted to go back home. She had this vision. She did her thing. She asked God, please go back to my village. But the king says, no, you're going to keep fighting. So he forced her to keep fighting, and she eventually was captured, and then she was sold to the English. And you would think, well, that they must have gone after her and tried to get her back, you would wish. Her former allies, the king and all the people who benefited from her efforts, abandoned her. And it seems that the king didn't even try to negotiate for her, you know, like give a ransom or something to get her back. Didn't even bother. Yeah. Which is just, wow. The English sold her for 10,000 francs to a bishop in northern France, who then tried her as a heretic and a witch. Remember the trials and we've looked at all this, the Inquisition. So she got caught up in the Inquisition business. And this trial took place in a city in northern France. She was accused of heresy for claiming to receive orders from heaven. She was also accused for insisting that those orders were given to her in French, because everybody knows they would have come in Latin. Okay. And also for dressing as a man. Okay. So she agreed to sign a recantation and was condemned to life imprisonment, which they would try to get you to sign some kind of confession, and then they would just let you just stay in prison for the rest of your life instead of torturing you to death. And so she, probably under pressure and threat of torture or what have you, agreed to sign it. But then she said that Saints Catherine and Margaret had spoken to her again, rebuked her for her recantation, which she now withdrew. She said, you know what? I shouldn't have signed it. I chickened out. And I got rebuked by the people who gave me the original vision, and so I'm taking it back. No, I'm not guilty. In consequence, she was taken to the old market square in Rouen, and she was burned alive. And her last request to the priest who accompanied her was to hold the crucifix high, speak the words of salvation loudly so she could hear them above the roar of the flames. This is tough stuff. She's tied up at a stake. They're going to light the fire, and they often, a very painful death didn't always happen very quickly. And all she's concerned about at that point is just, please hold the cross up and recite the gospel, the words of salvation, so I can hear them as I'm going to be with God. 20 years later, Dauphin came to Rouen, the city where she was executed, and ordered an inquiry, which, as was to be expected, exonerated her. So he did that much. He wouldn't pay for a ransom, try to get her back, didn't do anything to stop her being burned, but at least when he ended up in a town where she got burned, they examined the evidence, decided, you know what, she really wasn't guilty of all that stuff. We shouldn't have burned her. They shouldn't have burned her. And so in 1920, which is turning the clock forward a number of years, Pope Benedict XV granted her sainthood within the Roman Catholic Church, so she was declared a saint. Well, interesting enough, Pope Benedict XV, who's the most recent Benedict we're familiar with? It's the 16th. Okay, so this is the predecessor, the Benedict predecessor. This is they tend to pick up the names, you know. I mean, we're at 15 here, we got the 16. So anyhow, this is 1920. He declared her a saint. But long before that, she'd become a national hero in France. So anyways, here's a picture, a painting of her being burned at the stake. There you have the priest over there holding the crucifix per her request. It shows her in this picture holding a crucifix herself. She had her tied to the stake. You've got a fire going on here. And that's how she died. So kind of a mix of tragedy and yet amazing set of circumstances there. A very amazing set of circumstances. And you have, you know, I mean, so much of history at this time is dominated by the men as leaders and kings and so forth, right? Church leaders and so forth. But here you have a woman who's kind of a standout figure in military terms as well as in religious terms. So some kind of unusual stuff going on here. So just to kind of wrap up on the Hundred Years' War, in 1475, a peace treaty was finally signed between England and France. I don't know how long that lasted. I think those guys continue to get back into it from time to time. The long war had enormous consequences on the life of the church. So the church is affected by the culture. The church is affected by what goes on around it, for better or for worse. Since during part of the war, the popes resided in Avignon under the shadow of the French. Remember, we talked about the papacy and the pope moved from Rome to France. Then we ended up having multiple popes. Remember, we looked at all that. That was all during this 100-year war period. And so the English came to see the papacy as their enemy because the pope was living in France. They didn't like France. So why would they like the papacy? He's with those guys. He's with the wrong side. And so this started creating some divisions between England and the papacy, which is going to later develop, and England's going to break away from Catholicism. We're not there yet, but it's coming. Later, during the Western Schism, we look at that, the church was divided in its allegiance between two popes, eventually three popes, and nations chose their allegiance mostly based on how they aligned with each other in the war. And so the schism that created was very difficult. Sometimes circumstances in society can create division amongst believers, and it's very difficult to fix those divisions. We see those kinds of things in our day, don't we? The enduring international conflict strengthened nationalist sentiment in Europe and weakened the claims of the papacy to universal authority. So this is where nationalism began to shine. Instead of having a big empire like the Roman Empire or when the Germans took it over or the Eastern Empire, now you begin to see little nation states. All that the power gets broken up and divided into little pieces. And then the papacy begins to lose some of its tight hold on power and authority. So that's the Hundred Years' War, Joan of Arc. I have one other topic I want to hit this morning. I had envisioned great things out of this study when I took it on. And I think it's still helpful, but it just didn't end up being what I thought it would be. So it is what it is. Sometimes your data just is what it is, right? I was really disappointed personally that I didn't get to find more information. It seemed like the information about, I was just curious, what would it be like to be in a family in the Middle Ages? What were the roles of husband and wife like? What were the roles between parents and kids and things like that? And I found a little bit. I found a good bit, actually, but it just wasn't of the nature I thought it would be. So I'm going to present to you what I found. And I think it's helpful. I think it's interesting. We're going to look at several different aspects of family life, all just very briefly. So the first thing is the idea of consent in marriage. This is a topic that might ring in some of our ears, because it's a topic still discussed today. By the 12th century, European civilization had been transformed from a tribal to a feudal system. It was more gathering around the castle and the guy who owned the castle, people who worked for them and all that. But one profound change during this process, which affected all aspects of society, was the establishment of the rights of the individual as expressed in necessity for consent by parties entering into marriage. Now, I hate the wording of that sentence. I got it out of the history book directly. I just couldn't think of another way to put it. I probably should have worked harder at it. But let me just try to reword it now. Basically, what we're saying is that one change that took place in the 12th century was that when people were going to get married, it was the choice of the people getting married as to who they married, not the family. Does that make sense? We're familiar with this idea. I mean, this is, in some quarters in our society today, this is kind of still debated a little bit, right? In the course of establishing this fundamental norm, the church found itself in a great struggle with the landed aristocracy, who used arranged marriage and family ties to build alliances and extend power. So here's what we got going on. The aristocrats, the people, the powers that be, if you will, for centuries, the parents decided who their kids would marry. And they didn't always decide based on, oh, you know, my son would really like this daughter over here because she's so cute. Or the daughter really liked this son because he's such a cool guy. It was more like, hey, if we could get our son to marry into this family over here, we could pull our families together and form an alliance and become more powerful. And they could even make bargains. Hey, I'll tell you what, I will give your son my daughter if you will give me, you know, and they could make deals. So this was a useful tool to the families. The church at this time, think what you will about it, thought that was unacceptable. They said it should not be the parents' choice, it should be the kids' choice as to who they marry. Interesting, isn't it? Another topic we'll look at, influence on marriage practices. So there's a lot of things that go into the practice of marriage. And as in any time, you know, things don't happen in a vacuum. Things happen in a historical context and setting. And that's what we have going on in the Middle Ages. Views about marriage, views about relationships within marriage come from past influences. And there were three central influences on marriage customs in the Middle Ages, primarily. There was Roman law. Now you can see how the Roman law would, that Romans had a whole set of laws about governing marriage and relationships and families and all that kind of stuff. Then there was Germanic tradition. Remember, the Germans, pagans, came in and took over Rome. Well, they brought their traditions with them, their marriage traditions, as well as their other traditions. So that became an influence. And then last but not least, there is Christian theology. The Christians had a theology about marriage, and they had a say in what marriage should be like and shouldn't be like and so forth. So there was a kind of a battling going on between these three forces within the medieval society that was shaping the family. In some of these areas, value systems were in agreement. In others, they differed and needed to be modified and integrated into a coherent set of beliefs and practice. So there were some areas where the church, the Germans, and the Romans all agreed that marriage should be like such and such. But there were other areas where they disagreed, and so they had to hash out how it was going to work. Does that make sense? So what are the areas they agreed? Well, they agreed on the fact all three gave priority to the family unit and prohibited incest. That was a major priority for all three groups. All three sought to promote, this is the $50 word, exogamy? Exogamy? Yeah, exogamy. I had to look it up. It's marriage outside the family. You know the joke about in Arkansas that, you know, there's a lot of intermarriage and all this kind of crazy stuff? That was not a good idea. And all three of these groups said, yeah, it's better if we marry outside of our own family group. Family intermarriage is not good. Now, a lot of intermarriage happened within the royal family, which created a lot of health problems, as you well know. But generally speaking, all three groups recognized, yeah, you want to marry outside your family. They all agreed on that. Two areas of divergence from Christian practice included the Germanic practice of polygamy, marriage to more than one mate at a time, as you know, and then concubinage, the cohabitation with a person to whom one is not legally married. You can see the distinction between those two things. Now, I've read a little bit of conflicting information on this about the Germanic background, because I've heard that the Germans were very strict, especially in the requirements of their women. Maybe that's how it goes together. Maybe the men got to get away with whatever they wanted. I don't know. But I think the other way of putting the two ideas together is that especially the German leaders and heads of tribes especially practiced polygamy, because they felt like it was their right to do that. But whatever the case, there was a Germanic influence that tended toward saying, hey, what's wrong with polygamy? What's wrong with having multiple wives? The Romans and Germanic peoples accorded men greater sexual freedom than women, so there was a sort of a double standard. Men could get away with more in terms of sexual freedom than women could. Both the Germans and the Romans allowed men to dissolve their marriages, but only Roman law allowed women to divorce their husband. Now, the Germans didn't allow women to leave the man, but the Romans would allow a woman to divorce her husband. That was actually part of Roman law. What about the church? Well, while recognizing the authority of fathers and husbands, the church recognized that, the church prohibited all divorce and wanted to restrict sexual activity to married couples. Well, we're seeing this kind of come unraveled in our day, right? But this was a time, this is a society where you have a lot of sexual promiscuity, you have polygamy, you have concubinage, you have all kind of crazy stuff going on. You got the church coming in going, no. You know, once you're married, you stay married, you don't get divorced, and sex should be within the confines of marriage only. And that's what brought about that change in society, which we experienced way in the past, and now it's becoming a thing of the past, unfortunately for us. So the process by which these three value systems were integrated was slow and involved a lot of tension between secular and ecclesiastical values, as you might imagine. It was a battle. They were fighting it out. And of course, we still see that battle going on today, like I said, in reverse, but it's not unusual. This is not, you know, the church now is often at odds with the culture. We see that. It was back then too, even in the Middle Ages. The church has always had to fight for biblical values within society. Monogamy. We've already looked at polygamy. Prior to the 8th century, powerful men often followed the Germanic custom of having multiple wives as well as concubines. The practice had concentrated women among a small elite and left many men without the possibility of finding marriage partners. So I think a lot of times in the debate today, well, there's different ways people approach it, but a lot of people think of it in terms of, the poor women, multiple women with one guy. What this is pointing out is it was actually hard on a lot of the men too, because the aristocrats could take in large numbers of wives because they could afford them and they had the power to get them and secure them. And a lot of the poorer men, there weren't enough women left over for them. And so they had a hard time finding wives. So this created a problem societally on that basis. Again, that's apart from any moral considerations. It's just looking at the practical aspects. In the 8th century, the church was successful at imposing monogamy on the laity. So it was the church who brought in monogamy. One man, one woman. Monogamy helped distribute women more evenly across society, allowing more men to marry and more households to be established. So it had a positive societal benefit. Again, we're not even looking at the moral ins and outs of this. An interesting issue to explore, just looking at the practical outworking. This process, however, took centuries and was met with great resistance, as you might imagine, by the aristocracy, who resisted the imposition of monogamy openly in the 9th century and more indirectly, but everybody's added energetically on into the 13th. So for centuries, the aristocrats, number one, they didn't like the church telling them that they had to let the people marry who they want. And number two, they didn't like them telling they couldn't marry more than one person. They're like, where'd the church get off telling us this stuff? And the church is like, no, this is the way it should be. You guys need to shape up. So they got this battle going on, which I thought was interesting. Extension of church control. Again, we're just taking little mini topics. This is going to be it. I'm not going to spend weeks on family life. I just thought it was worth touching on some of these areas. In the 9th century, a wedding was essentially a secular ceremony that a priest might be invited to bless. So marriage really started off kind of secular at that point. By the 12th century, marriage had become one of the 7 sacraments and was, as such, celebrated in church as a public and ecclesiastical ritual. So more and more, from the 9th to the 12th century, the idea of marriage was looked at as a sort of religious institution, if you will, a Christian idea. And now we're seeing, again, a reverse of this now, aren't we, in our society? You know, for years it was like, if you were going to get married, you had to get married in a church, pretty much. I mean, I know there was all those people who eloped and went to Vegas and had a justice of the peace do it. But I'm just saying, generally speaking, people feel like there's a need to do it in a church. But people are getting away from that idea. People are getting away from the idea of having to get married at all in our society, as a matter of fact. But as you well know, an outcome of this change was the doctrine of the indissolubility of marriage. A couple united by God should not be separated for earthly considerations. So that, again, the idea of the church teaching marriage is permanent. You should not get divorced. And again, I'm sure there were the exceptions and all that. I'm not getting into so many doctrines we could get into here and discuss the ins and outs there. I'm just giving big, broad stroke pictures here, okay? The church also unsuccessfully tried to eliminate secular marriages, but they couldn't pull that off completely. So as long as there was mutual consent and as long as everybody agreed that they weren't going to dissolve the marriage, that marriage was permanent, they would go ahead and bless it, even if it was a secular marriage, it wasn't done in a church. Sex and marriage. Many medieval people believed that virginity was a higher state than marriage and procreation. We've talked about this a little bit, actually. Thus, a celibate lifestyle was adopted by many religious people. We've seen that. There were also some ongoing ancient traditions that condemned sexual pleasure as sinful and sought to regulate it in sexual acts. Now, I'm talking about Christian. We're talking about pagan religions. There were some who condemned the idea of enjoying sex for the pleasure of it. So that was going on. That was another one of those forces in society. The church taught that procreation, not sexual enjoyment, was the important outcome of the conjugal act and prohibited any sex act that did not fall into that category. Basically, what we're talking about here is, and this is still the Roman Catholic Church's stance to this day, is that they condemn any kind of birth control. Now, they didn't have the methods of birth control we have today, but there was some efforts at birth control at that time. We do know that abortions took place, even in the ancient Roman world, which is a brutal form of birth control, obviously. But there are other methods that the midwives came up with, whether they work or not. There's the timing methods and all this. There's all kind of ways that people would work at trying to keep the sex act from producing kids. And the church was against that. They said the purpose of sex is kids. And it's kind of like, if you want to enjoy it, fine. But having the kids is the big thing. Again, I know if you compare that to today's thinking, we're in a different world. Just telling you how the church viewed it at the time. And yet, it was apparent that in society, sexual activity outside of marriage was quite common, even amongst the, as we've seen with the priests and the popes and everything. You know, you don't change human nature. You can make all the structure, infrastructures you want to impose on things, but the reality is that these things go on. Childbirth and baptism. Again, we're just fly-by, hitting topics, kind of high level. Because of limited medical knowledge and unsterile conditions, having a baby is one of the most dangerous time in a medieval woman's life. Many, many women died in childbirth. Many. Many husbands had went through many wives, not through divorce, but because their wife died in childbirth. And they didn't have very effective birth control, and it wasn't very common, so women were continually having kids and dying. Part of the life. Midwives assisted in childbirth, drawing on knowledge and experience they had from generations. By 13th century, there were midwives being licensed and trained. It was, if possible, an infant was baptized in a formal ceremony about 1 week after its birth. And I think this grew out of partially ways of, it had a governmental value because that person could be counted when they were baptized, but I think there was also some thinking about the salvation of a child if they were baptized or something like that. I'm not signing off on that. I'm just telling us the thinking of the time. Another quick look. Childhood responsibilities. Between the ages of 4 and 8, peasant children were occupied mainly with children's games, and usually only after the age of 8 were they given chores, most of them at home. The boys would guard sheep or geese, pasture or water oxen and horses, and do some gleaning after the harvest. Girls would pick wild fruit, fetch water, and help with the cooking. So there were roles within the home. At adolescence, the boys joined their fathers in the field. I would presume the women joined their mothers, but it didn't say that. So, and then in preparation for adulthood, among all classes, noble, artisan, and peasant, some adolescents left home to be educated, to learn a trade, or become servants. So this is something that's really kind of different than our society. There was a lot of kids being farmed out somewhere to go get trained to do something. That's not very common in our day. Sons and daughters of nobility, this is not just the poor people, were sent to other aristocratic households, often those of relatives, the sons to train as knights and the daughters to learn social graces. I guess they felt like the parents couldn't do a good job. I don't know why they did this. It was just, but Sandy and I do a lot of reading about medieval fiction and stuff, and we see a lot of this in the stories that we read. It's just very common. A city boy might be boarded out as an apprentice to a master of a craft and his parents paying for his maintenance. So one way that boys could train for their future trade was to go become an apprentice with somebody who knew how to do something and learn from them. Most guilds did not allow boys to be apprenticed to their own fathers, so apprenticeship normally meant leaving home at an early age. So boys would be farmed out. You're going to be a whatever. You're going to be a glassblower. You're going to be a blacksmith. You're going to be whatever you're going to be. Even middle-aged boys who went to school were commonly apprenticed once they had learned to read and write. Education was considered a luxury, whereas competence in business or a craft was viewed as life-sustaining. As in all societies, even in our own society today, we're discovering the hard way. The only way society survives is for everybody in society to be doing productive things and work. You can't have unproductive people in large numbers or the society is going to starve. So that's why they said, you know, education is great, but you learn how to read and write, go learn a craft. We need help. Last topic, preparation for adulthood. Peasants. Male and female, actually, next last topic. Sometimes left home to become servants. A peasant might, in effect, sell his daughter to a master who paid him a modest lump sum, fed, clothed, and lodged her for small wages to accumulate for her dowry. Women had to provide a dowry. When a woman was of marriageable age, the employer undertook to find her a match, or she might go back home to marry. Boys also might go to work on a manorial farm or other peasant families. A noble or peasant boy might board at a cathedral. This is another place where children might be trained to become monks or nuns in a church. And they would learn Latin, and they would learn grammar, philosophy, prayer. Every day the student was required to recite a part of what he'd learned the day before. So they did reviews in the monasteries with the kids. It's like we do in Sunday school, right? Students were required to write compositions imitating the authors they studied. And to ensure their reading was retained and not precipitated to fly by spurs, in other words, their knowledge didn't just fly away after they learned it, each student daily had to memorize a poem or story and recite it. So memorization was a big deal. And when they did poorly, they were beaten. There you go. All right. Well, that's it. It's a quick flyby of family life. Gives you a just snapshot of something went on with kids, with parents, and so forth. Hope that was helpful. We are now, it's amazing, we have one lesson left. We are now officially finished with the Middle Ages. And we are now going to begin looking at the dawn of the Reformation. So it's kind of a tail end of the Middle Ages, but it's moving us through some, especially people like Jan Hus and people like this, who are pointing us toward the Reformation. This is going to become big on the scene pretty soon. I think probably next week I will probably start the lesson, as we do when we get the breaks, and do a helicopter view and kind of say, you know, we've looked at a lot of stuff. And maybe do a quick helicopter flyby thing, and then maybe start to get into some of this. So that's where I hope to go with that. All right. Well, Martin was nice enough to bring snacks this morning. Does anybody want to volunteer to bring snacks for next week? Debbie? All right, thanks. Discussion time. All right, here we go. Discussion question number one. Joan of Arc was one of the rare exceptions historically of women serving in combat, much less leading in combat. In our day, feminists have sought to challenge this thinking. They say women should be in combat just like men. Do you think there is something to the idea that only men should serve in combat roles, or is that just patriarchal thinking that we should abandon? Please explain your answer. As always, we don't shy away from controversial issues. Possible question number two. We saw today that during the Middle Ages that the aristocracy held to the idea that parents should decide who their children would marry, whereas the church challenged this assumption and insisted that individuals had the right to choose their own spouse, which is pretty much the practice in the West in our day. Do you think the church was right in insisting on the right of individuals to choose their own spouse? Or would we be better off returning to the practice of parents choosing who their children will marry, a practice that we've seen, for example, in Old Testament times, right? Please defend your answer and have fun doing it. And last possible question, what do you think about the medieval practice of farming out your kids to another family or institution in order to train them for their life occupation, as opposed to being the one that trains them at home to do that? And of course, you can always come up with your own questions. So there you go. Some possible questions. What would you all like to entertain here? This is where we have discussion with one another. Yeah. I can't imagine.
One is when you were talking about Joan of Arc, you were surprised he accepted her. It's like when Saul accepted David's offer to slew the giant, you know.
Yeah.
Very similar situation, at least he was male.
Right.
There was Deborah in the Old Testament.
Deborah is that one exception in the Old Testament.
He was supposed to go, but Barak wouldn't go without her.
Because he was a weenie, yeah. Well, I'll go if you go with me. Yeah.
The top guys wouldn't have all the women, and the younger guys wouldn't have any options.
Just like we talked about.
When they became Christians, he made them give up their extra wives.
Interesting.
And told them they were being greedy.
Okay. Well, there you go. Something, a little historical note there.
Hold on. Patton said that at the New Hebrides to the chieftains?
Yeah. When they became Christians,
interesting.
So in a completely separated world and culture, the same thing were happening, the same types of...
Yes. There was a lot of, like, raiding other tribes, taking their women. It was causing a lot of friction all the way around. He didn't just randomly make that decision. There were a lot of problems related to the fact that they were doing that. He just used that as a way to solve the problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm just interested in the fact that these human beings were sitting like this over here on the other side of the world in an aristocratic culture. There was the same type of problems. That's amazing.
Are you familiar with the Ask Pastor John podcast?
With the what?
Ask Pastor John podcast.
I know the name.
Questions like this. And one question that came to John Piper was, are there any exceptions to the expectation for husbands and fathers to protect their family? Consider a situation where the husband is sick or feeble,
okay,
or not a very stout guy, and the wife is stronger, maybe had some karate lessons or something.
or knew how to use a pistol or something.
And there's an attempted break-in, right? And is the husband going to say, you go take care of it. You're more equipped than me. And Piper said, well, you know, maybe they should go together.
Like Barack and Deborah, right? I've got you guys with me.
You know, making some effort to still protect.
Yeah.
Even though you're acknowledging your own limitations.
Right.
And you're acknowledging the capabilities of your spouse. Maybe even like on a military level, what if there's this military genius who's a female, who strategy's best served by her being on the front line? I don't know.
I
think principally, we see that men have a role and responsibility to protect. If you take that on a national level, that can be applied in military. But not to necessarily exclude the fact that there can be exceptions to the rule.
Right. True.
You know, with Barack and Deborah, because Deborah had to go with him, God said a woman will get the honor from this whole thing. And it was a woman who killed Sisera, the captain of the army fighting against Israel, by putting a tent peg.
Yeah, tent peg through his head.
Part of the speculation that went through my head with the Joan of Arc thing, whenever it came up, is like the possibility that they didn't have anything, like it's just like, oh, okay, she's gone, kind of thing. One of the things I started asking myself was, well, is it possible that because of how she was going against the, you know, the common gender roles of the time, as it were, if they were kind of starting to look at that as, well, you know, we used her when she was necessary, but if she's no longer necessary, this is a shame upon us that she was doing what the men should be doing. Let's let them have her and just be done with her, because she shouldn't have been doing this in the first place.
Ashamed of her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A shame in what she was, you know, ultimately. What's that?
Ashamed of herself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it was kind of a way of saying, let's correct this by just letting them punish her, and have her, and we won't have anything to do with her. She kind of served her purpose, and to have her back is going to further that shame, and you know, just.
But they didn't really like hand her over to the enemy. I mean, in effect, that's what ended up happening. She wanted to go back home. She was done.
Sure.
She wanted to pull out of that role. She thought it was weird.
But they just
said, no, you're going to keep being a leader and keep fighting. And then she ended up getting captured, and then, all this that happened, and then they didn't do anything about it. I mean, it could be, psychologically, I can picture that. That'd be a guess on our part, but that's possible. Yeah.
I don't know if Navy SEALs still have the rule that girls can't be Navy SEALs. Do you know?
I don't know.
But when challenged on it, I think top generals have said, hey, when you have a mix on the front line, it puts it in a very difficult situation when that male teammate is going to
defend a woman.
Yes, protect his female counterpart.
Yeah.
And risk maybe the entire team because of that instinct to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I do believe it's instinctive. I even think it could be teased out biblically, but it's not explicitly given. That's what makes it tough. But I think it's a part of everybody's nature to think that way, normally. Of course, in our case, we're going against human nature every place we turn in our society. We're becoming bizarre in places, as we know. But
well, let me ask this question. In the United States Army today, are women allowed in combat roles?
I've heard that they are. Huh?
In other words, we have women pilots.
Infantry?
Yeah,
pilots.
Yeah, pilots. We have a lot of women pilots.
Yeah.
Well, depending on how you define it, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
What concerns me is, okay, we've got, obviously, I think we've had women that want to serve. serve in those roles. And I think our culture and our military have resisted that, but now that, I guess that battle is over. But what concerns me is there have been rumblings of the past few years that if we have a draft, we're going to draft your daughters too. I mean, and what I think is terrible is we've got maybe 1% or less of the population of our females that want to be in these roles. Yeah, these active combat roles.
Yeah.
When probably a high 90s would say, not only do I not want to, I would not be very good at it. And when I heard that maybe about 10 years ago and Allie started getting letters, my thought at that point was, you cannot have my daughter.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
You know, you can draft my son and he'll go fight for us, but I will not. I would go to my death.
Yeah.
Or I would let you take my daughter.
He's giving you up, Andrew.
Well, folks, we've had good discussion. I've ran us over as usual. Nothing changed, right? Father, thank you for this time and for this good discussion, for this time to look into history, and be with us as we move into the next phase, and pray that we will continue to profit and benefit from these things. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. You're dismissed.